how far in the God we come tonight to study the stupendous events of our day in the light of thy word. Lord, thou give us clear thinking, and may we do our best to relate all that takes place to thy sovereign word, thine own sovereignty, and the church of which we're part. So we give thee thanks for the insights which thou hast given us in thy word. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
It has been suggested that instead of doing the present tonight and to discuss with you the issues of the present campaign, in no campaign do the issues suddenly appear out of the clear blue. So that when we begin to look at 1984, we have to go back to 1980. And really we should go back to 1976. And very briefly, to look even behind that for the issues which now are so apparent and which have become the overriding issues in this campaign. What I shall say will not be necessarily in the spirit of personal criticism, but will be in the attempt to evaluate a political position to know as they exist today in the light of the sovereign word of God. And that's all I can do. But to understand 1984, you must go back to 1932.
1932 what?
1932. The election of Franklin Roosevelt over Herbert Hoover. Now, Herbert Hoover was not a good campaigner. He was a graduate engineer from Leon Stanford, one of the most highly educated and best trained men we've ever had in the presidency since the original men. A man of sterling character, but not a good campaigner. He tended to treat the American people as if they were a graduate course at Stanford University, which was a mistake, because they were not in the graduate school of Stanford. And at that time, Stanford was a very fine school. And it had an excellent engineering department. Now, in the election of 1932, of course you know that the Great Depression of 1929 had broken in October, just 55 years ago, the 29th of October, the stock market had crashed. And it shook Wall Street. It shook the nation. And literally, bankers and brokers, particularly brokers, were jumping out of windows on Wall Street in utter despair at the turn of events. By 1932, it was worse. But the election 1932, featuring on the one hand Herbert Hoover and on the other Franklin Roosevelt, was not merely a contest between political parties. No, it was that. But behind that, there was the personal platform of Franklin Roosevelt. Note what I say. There was the personal platform of Franklin Roosevelt. The Democratic Party platform for 1932 was, on the whole, a good platform, as party platforms go. Not that it was perfect, but it was not. It certainly wasn't radical. They called for a balanced budget, a reduction of federal expenditures, and so on. Roosevelt, of course, did not intend to run that platform. And he pushed it to one side and ran on his own. to understand what happened, you'll have to understand Roosevelt. He was a Harvard graduate, and even at that time, Harvard was turning to the left. Not as violent as it did today, as it had today. It still had some excellent scholars in the faculty. But the general atmosphere was one of Unitarian latitude, of Unitarianism in theology, and more or less radical democratic philosophy. He imbibed a great deal from Theodore Roosevelt, more than he was willing to admit, because Theodore had been a Republican, but he'd been a radical Republican. Now, in 1932, Roosevelt had his own platform. And you must remember, at that time, there was no national radio hookup. In other words, the National Broadcasting Company had been founded, and the Columbia system had been founded, but they did not have national hookups, partly because of time zone, and partly because of the diversity of interest in the radio audience. And the things, of course, would say would be aired at 7 o'clock in the evening as private evening program on a New York station. We would come on at 4 o'clock in the evening at Los Angeles or San Francisco or someplace else. The result was that they beamed locally for the time zone. And this is very important to observe, because it enabled Roosevelt to address himself to particular regional audiences. When he was in the South, he'd speak about the price of cotton, which was then, as I remember, 4.5 to 5 cents a pound, or tobacco, which was roughly 5 or 6, 7 cents a pound. When he was in the Middle West, he'd speak of the price of corn and wheat, which was low. When he was in New England, he'd speak about the industrial situation, unemployment in Pennsylvania, New York, and the industrial Northeast. When he was in the Pacific Coast, he would address himself to the particular problems of the Pacific Coast, so that he could speak to the farmers about the necessity of raising the price of farm products. But if the workers in New England were out of jobs, or in Pennsylvania, or New York, or New Jersey, who didn't have any work at all, they wouldn't take kindly to raising the price of food. Or if he talked about the price of raising the wage rates in the industrial East, and therefore raising the price of manufactured goods, the farmers wouldn't like that one little bit. So he carefully beamed his addresses to the selected audiences. Now, if you go back to the old Literary Digest, which became defunct in 1937, and if you go back in the newspaper files, New York Times, we'll take the New York Times for the Eastern, and take the Atlanta Constitution for the Southern main articles, or take the Chicago Tribune for the Upper Midwest, or the St. Louis Globe Dispatch or Post Democrat for the Lower Mississippi Valley, Missouri, or take the Denver Post for the Rocky Mountain section, or take, of course, the Los Angeles and San Francisco papers for the Pacific Coast. You will see that on the whole they featured those addresses which were spoken to the particular audiences. The Sunday papers didn't always adhere to this. The New York Times would sometimes pay attention to what he would say on the Pacific Coast. And sometimes the Chicago Tribune would pay attention to some things he said in the East. But that was not generally the case. The result was that Roosevelt could focus in on what he wanted to focus. Now, in a few cases, he was able to, or I should say he did, state his basic philosophy. And I want to come to that, and I want to read to you. It's in the book, so, but it's a very, very important. This was the famous, or the very important, rather, Commonwealth Club address, which he gave in San Francisco on 23rd September 1932. Now, this address got practically no attention.
What page?
255. Now, there's a very important paragraph here, which was his basic political philosophy, and which I found in the series The Papers of Franklin Roosevelt from 1933-1941. There was a collection, and there were a published collection of all these papers and addresses It's in their public papers at page 742 to 756. And this was the Commonwealth Club address. And you can see why it did not receive much attention. Now, I want to read this one paragraph here. The Declaration of Independence discusses the problems of government in terms of a contract. Perforce, if we should follow thinking out of which it grew, under such a contract, rulers were accorded power, and the people consented that power on the consideration that they were accorded certain rights. Now, that is totally false.
So isn't that feudalism?
It wasn't even feudalism. It's Roosevelt's interpretation of democracy. This is totally contrary to the Magna Carta. See, under such a contract, rules were accorded power, and the people decided that power on the consideration that they were accorded certain rights. And all the medieval political philosophers, John of Salisbury, and of course, St. Thomas Aquinas, there's not a hint that this is the case. Jefferson would not have accepted this. You see, Jefferson taught that nature has given to mankind certain political rights, and that in order to preserve these rights, mankind entered into a social contract. I mean, this is not Jefferson. This can be a logical deduction from Jefferson. It's the degradation of the Declaration of Independence, but not Jefferson, to be fair to Jefferson. Jefferson insisted that all men, by nature, have certain inalienable rights, and that government is instituted to protect those rights, just the reverse of this. Now, I'll show you what Roosevelt really had in mind. Let's look at this next statement. The task of statesmanship has always been the redefining of these rights in terms of a changing and growing social order. Now, I'm fully aware of the weakness of Jefferson. I don't admire him, but Jefferson never said this. And yet, he is saying that he did, because he starts out by talking about the Declaration of Independence. Note Roosevelt. New conditions impose new requirements upon government and those who conduct government. Therefore, the conclusion, you readjust. Human rights.
What he did.
Yes, he did. You redefine it. And in terms of a changing social condition. Now, remember this, that Hitler was echoing this very philosophy in Germany. There's no real difference. All the language is different. Roosevelt used a soothing charm, where Hitler used a hysterical note which was suited more to the German mind, but the essence is the same. Hitler was more forthright. Roosevelt was more slick. But it was essentially the same kind of thinking. Now, let me show you again on the next page, the bottom of the page, when Roosevelt was discussing the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933. I tell you frankly that this is a new and untried path. But I tell you with equal frankness, which wasn't true, that an unprecedented condition calls for the trial of new means to rescue agriculture. If a fair administrative trial is made of it and does not produce the hoped for results, I shall be the first to acknowledge it and so advise it. That act hasn't worked yet. It's been tried now for 51 years and it hasn't worked. It didn't work in his administration. He did not advise it. In fact, when they passed the Readjustment Act in 1938, he fought it. Congress itself took the bull by the horns. Now, I'm not trying to discuss the AAA. I'm trying to point out that he he approached all the problems of government in the light of his doctrine of changing conditions demand a changing conception of human rights. In an article or in his excellent editorials, and I'm going to, I think it was March or April 1933, David Lawrence, who at that time was the editor of the United States News, gave a tremendous commentary in which he said that, in essence, that there's much more to the election of 1932 than appears on the surface. It's not only a change of political parties, it's a change of political direction. It's a watershed for the American political system. Now, I'm paraphrasing, that's not a direct quote. David Lawrence was a man of great insight, a very able man. He started the United States News. He'd been publishing a newspaper called the United States Daily, and he decided he would make it into a weekly. He knew Washington better than the Washingtonians did. And they always said about the United States News that the members of Congress read it to find out what they'd already done. Which wasn't always true, because some of the congressmen couldn't either understand what they did or understand the United States News. And that is still true. No?
No reason.
No reason. What I'm saying is this, that the philosophy which now has dominated the Democratic Party, and which Mondale and Ferraro have brilliantly exhibited, has its roots back here as a political force in our history. Now, of course, it was not new then, but Roosevelt gave it a popularity. Mr. Average American had no idea about the Commonwealth Address of 1932. Because it's been carefully shielded from it. Not by the press so much, but by the administration. Now, this was the dominant concept of the New Deal. Turn to page 258 with me. I want you to read with me, this is a direct quote from the congressional record, which I found. It's talking about a bill, the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933. I said, this is Hugo Black, Senator from Alabama. I'm not complaining about this bill being too reactionary. I admit that it's revolutionary. There's no question about it. It is a departure from the federal forms of government, which has fallen in the past. I'm not complaining about the fact the United States, the President of the United States, with conditions they are, has seen with open eyes a situation which demanded bold and aggressive action. I applaud him with all my heart for being willing to stand in the outmoded, on the outmoded antiquated form of the past to meet present conditions, but being willing to step forward boldly and aggressively in an effort to secure the economic unbalance which exists in the nation. In other words, he was applauding Roosevelt. He was later appointed to the Supreme Court by Mr. Roosevelt. And again, you have a quote up there by Representative Marlin from Oklahoma. Representative Hillebrand, page 259. Neither property rights nor antique documents should ever obstruct human rights. First fallacy. The communists always drove a wedge between human rights and property rights. That was the common talk in Russia in 1933 with Stalin and Lenin and company. Roosevelt adopted, Hildebrand did, a New Deal Democrat. Neither property rights nor antique documents should ever obstruct human rights. But does property have a right in itself, or do humans have a right in property? The rights of the whole people precede the rights of any corporation complaining about regulation and any mortgage holder who must evict a helpless and broken farmer. The rights of the whole people take priority over any constitutional bend in any age, any country, even our own. In other words, the doctrine of human rights by the New Deal is going to be used to sabotage the Constitution. To put it more bluntly, they were going to use the doctrines of democracy to sabotage constitutional government. There's another quote by Hildebrandt on the next page. The point is, if you'll read here, you'll see that the Christian century and the radicals in the churches highly applaud the New Deal. In other words, what Roosevelt was able to do was to forge an illegitimate marriage, a shotgun marriage, between the New Deal and liberal churches. And this is a very important point, because beginning with the Roosevelt administration, the liberal churches and the Federal Council churches began to take a very active part in guiding national affairs. In recent times, Walter Mondale has raised the specter, of course, he greatly resents the influence of Jerry Falwell in national affairs. He can't stand it. Well, and he says that he has introduced a new note in American political life, that is the intrusion of the church in national affairs. That's not true. It's simply not true. Now, I don't know whether Walter Mondale knows that or not. Geraldine Ferraro, I doubt she knows it. I doubt that the newspaper editorials written about it know it. I certainly doubt that the TV commentators on the 7 o'clock or 6:30 news have any idea about it. But it's true that they began it. The conservatives did not begin it. As a matter of fact, ladies and gentlemen, the independent fundamentalist attitude of the 1910s, 20s, and 30s was just the reverse. If you study the history of the conservative churches, as you look at Mine Holy Alliance, you'll find this to be the case, that they were just the opposite. The fundamentalist attitude had been, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't chew, and I don't go with them, I do. Whereas they kept strictly away. It was they who held to the false doctrine of the war between church and state. The liberals had demolished it. Even while they so passionately quoted Thomas Jefferson, they took the sledgehammer of expediency and beat down the wall of separation. In 1932, at Indianapolis, the National Council of the Federal Council of Churches revised its Social Creed 1908 and rewrote it into the Social Creed 1932, in which they openly espoused the coming New Deal. Is this very interesting? They met in Rochester, New York, in late November, December 1932, and praised Roosevelt's coming New Deal. As a matter of fact, they outdid him in their call for socialism and radical reform. Roosevelt agreed with them, but being political more smart than they, Roosevelt most of the time had a pretty good idea of how far he could go and how far he couldn't go. But the Christian century and the Congregational Christian Church, which became the United Church of Christ later, they were in the vanguard with the Methodist Episcopal Church North. Bishop Bromley and these men were way in the vanguard and were extremely radical and were, for the most part, pro-communist, along with Harriet Ward, whom I mentioned, I think, last time, who wrote the Social Creed of 1908 for the Methodist Church and for the Federal Council, and then who wrote the Social Creed of 1932. So that the intrusion of the church into the state was a liberal reaction in favor of Roosevelt and against the Republican Party and its conservative policies of the 1920s and down to 1932. I want to make that point very, very clear. There are many things with which I do not agree in Mr. Falwell. I do not mean to say I don't agree with these. With his moral concepts, I do. But I cannot accept his theology, which lies behind it, because he's built a tremendous edifice on a weak foundation. You cannot possibly meet the onslaughts of humanism. You cannot meet the onslaughts of humanism on the basis of a dispensational theology or the fundamentalist theology which Fowell holds. The curious thing is this, that it was the fundamentalist theology which swept the churches, the evangelical churches, in the late 1910s, well, from 1916 on to 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. It was that theology which kept the evangelical churches from following the liberal churches into politics. And to that extent, it was Fowell's own theological background which allowed the present situation to develop, against which he's now fighting, which is a strange reaction. But Mr. Fowell's moral indignities and his moral strength have counteracted against his own theological convictions, forced him to go against his theology into the forming the moral journal has done. Now, in that I approve, but I do not approve of theology, because ultimately his movement cannot survive unless he changes theology. But now back to the main thrust. By the way, other questions?
Yeah. I was...
You have the floor.
So talking about the end of the fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the board, list of board of directors for the Pilgrim out of Boston, New England.
You mean the original Pilgrims?
No, the political... You know, got the mailing sat now.
Oh, the Milgram, the Russ Walton's group?
Yeah, Russ Walton.
I know him well.
Okay. Three of the members, two of the people on the board of directors are graduates from Bob Jones University. and three of them are really what you might call militant fundamentalists on the board of directors. And all three of them are, I'm not saying that as a defense, it's just a question mark, That three of them are militant premillennial fundamentalists, really.
I might say I was on the lectureship at the Des Moines Foundation with Russ Walton. He is one wonderful gentleman. Does anybody here know him?
Yeah.
He is an extremely fine gentleman.
Yeah.
He's a very, very little man. And what has happened is that he has totally outgrown his board of directors. He's amazing. He's a Reformed Calvinistic Baptist, and except on the matter of infant baptism and immersion, he would be except on the PCA Church.
Mm.
I have a tremendous admiration for him.
Mm.
But
what's his name?
Russ, his RUSS Walton. He's president of Pilgrim Society,
yeah.
And they are you on his mailing list?
Yes, I am. I thought maybe you might comment on that, the fact that those premillennials were on his board of directors.
I will. The answer is that what Russ Walton is doing,
yeah,
is trying to reestablish in his bulletins and so on, the fact that we have a Christian heritage, and he has a tremendous lecture on this very point. Now, you see, his board of directors is pretty much in the same position as Jerry Falwell, that they so much approve of Russ Walton's thrust against liberalism that they have followed him even against their own theological convictions. Now, what I'm trying to point out to you, then, in 1984, if I might use that phrase, made famous by Orwell, has its roots back here. Rosa, as I have, I think, shown to you, laid the foundations for the doctrine of political expediency as over against strictly constitutional interpretation. He even went so far as to undermine the Declaration of Independence, to which he professed such undying allegiance. He went so far as to use expediency to overthrow constitutional restraints. He engaged the in his administration men like Harry Hopkins, who was a blatant unbeliever, and Henry Wallace, a blatant unbeliever, Henry Morgenthau, a Zionist Jew, and Harold Ickes, one of the most blasphemous super duper drunks I've ever had the pleasure of not working with. I did work with him. I was one of his hirelings. The whole upper crust of New Deal was in their own inner circle blatantly unchristian and anti-Christian. They very seldom let out because at that time Roosevelt had to placate the solid South, and he could not have won without the South, and he was well aware of that until he made the famous breaks in 1937 and 1938. So he tried to play along with the Christian elements in the country. And of course, at that time, there was a very strong Christian bloc in the Senate and in the House. There was Senator Walter F. George of Georgia. He was one of the great, really great Southern Baptist leaders, and at one time the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. And there was Senator Dick Russell, a great Presbyterian whose brother I knew, Jeb Russell, pastor of the Second Presbyterian Church in Memphis. There were men like that who stood solidly. Carter Glass of Virginia, a very loyal conservative Episcopalian, and Pat McCarran, who was a very orthodox, very conservative, unbelievably conservative Roman Catholic in his political, social, and ethical outlook, and felt all along he was in alignment with the Roman Church in his views, and I think probably he was. He was what I would call a truly devoted Roman Catholic. Do you remember him?
No, I've never heard of him.
I had the pleasure of working with him with Willow Smith on the Senate Committee, and he delighted me.
Was the phrase that's so popular today that you hear often from politicians, the separation of church and state, born during the Roosevelt years?
No. It was never used. Well, at least to my knowledge, it was never used. It really began with Jimmy Carter. You may remember when he was running for office. I'm not sure it was Time or Newsweek, or one of the big magazines had a long interview with him in 1970. It was sometime early in 1976. Possibly late 75, and in the discussions and the question and answer, he used the phrase, "I'm a born again Christian." And now, in the evangelical circles, had been used before, but I mean, in national politics, no. To as far as I know.
I thought it'd be earlier than that.
No. The reporter seized upon it when Jimmy Carter openly stated he was born again, and used it sometimes for him, but mostly against him, because they couldn't understand the strange fish. Of course, there are many things the reporters don't understand. Now, why am I giving this as part of the background? Because in 1932, the impetus towards a humanistic concept of life, political life, was developed. At the same time, John Dewey, Vivian Thayer, and a few other men, five or six, seven, eight, formed the Progressive Education Association, which was the communist wing in education in this country. Now, the men who Dewey was a communist, also a humanist, but Not all the men openly admitted this, but they parroted their communist law in education. They got their ideas from Russia, and progressive education was designed to break down the American heritage in education. I don't know. How many of you ever heard of Black Mountain College? It was founded, it was in Black Mountain, right next to Montreat. it was the head of it was Dr. Rice. They picked up from the school in Winter Park in Florida.
Rollins.
Well, he was a very progressive educator, and the school was so progressive that the people of Black Mountain suggested they might want to go elsewhere, and it failed. But it was a it was a house of prostitution, among other things. I'm not even sure that the girls in the dorms had shades, but they didn't use them. it was a free loving, free thinking, free acting school, which was allegedly a college. Well, and then there's a group of schools known as the progressive schools, and they gained a great influence through Dewey. And this is the time that modern education began to be used against the American heritage. So you have education and the church and the New Deal working against the Constitution and against evangelical Christianity. Now, of course, Roosevelt always piously went to church. He was an Episcopalian. there's a bishop in central New York in whose diocese his home was, and I was there, Bishop Fisk. Bishop Fisk made the remark to the Associated Press one time that if Mr. Roosevelt were Episcopalian, he had never known it, which pretty much dismissed Mr. Roosevelt's affiliation with the Episcopal Church. Bishop Fisk was a very old-line, conservative, evangelical Episcopalian. Did you ever hear him? Well, he was not bishop over New York City. I don't know what he had. It was up out in New York City. It was central New York, or maybe. I don't know the name of it, but I know he was a bishop. I know he took a dim view of the president and his religious affiliation. But unbelief became acceptable in the administration. It had not been the Hoover administration. Now, it's not to say all the men in the Hoover administration were outstanding Christians. But if they weren't, they kept it to themselves. Some of them, like Frank Kellogg, the very able Secretary of State, were. Hoover was a devoted man. There was a tremendous religious change, a tremendous political change, a tremendous social change underway with Roosevelt. Now, the war did two things. The war revived a great deal of patriotism among Mr. Average Joe American. and everybody went all out for the war effort. And even the National Council of Churches, which had become so adamant, the Federal Council had been adamantly patriotic or anti-military and pro-Russian before the war, had the muzzled gun, so to speak. Now, they finally found out that they could bless the war, and they held a very famous conference at Delaware, Ohio in 1943, in which they said that they could now accept the war since it would end all totalitarianism and it could be used to producing a social welfare state in this country. I'm paraphrasing what it said. In 1943, Roosevelt took another great step towards the modern democratic platform. On March 11, 1943, he sent a message to Congress, which I have somewhere in the book, in which he announced that the country now had it within its power to bring in the millennium. Now, if you remember 1943, most Americans didn't see the millennium hovering over the horizon. As a matter of fact, it didn't look like it was going to come in some sense. But his thrust was that it's now in the hands of government to bring in the millennium. And he would do it by taking over all the major industries of the country. And the word be used for that reason. Well, it just so happened that the committee in charge of post-war planning, when the Senate was headed by one Walter F. George, in 1938, you may remember, as I told you, that Roosevelt tried to purge the Senate of its 11 great members who had killed the Senate, the Supreme Court reform bill. Well, when those men came back, they were not exactly happy with Mr. Roosevelt. And after, I forget when it was, but I had been to see Senator George about something. And I asked him, I said, whatever happened to that bill that Mr. Roosevelt proposed? And Mr. George had a tremendous old-fashioned desk with about 100 cubbyholes, literally, it was a big man's thing. And he pointed up and said, you see that over there? I said, yes. He said, well, it's up there. I said, when will it come out? It's going to come out. And so Mr. Roosevelt's effort to use the war to transform the economy and the whole national political outlook were stymied. Because not that Senator George would have accepted even if he hadn't tried to purge him, but the purge had given him added zest to thwarting Mr. Roosevelt. Now, George would back the war, but when it came to post-war planning, when it came to things like that, now, after war, the patriotism died down, and in 1948, Truman won. Truman was totally incapable of being president. He had been a member of the Pendergrass Gang in Kansas City, Missouri. He had never been trained for the presidency. He did not know that Roosevelt was dying. Everybody else in Washington did. But they had not told Mr. Truman, which added to his natural incapacity, it boded ill for the country. Now, Mr. Truman, in his blunt way, was a patriot. He wanted to do the right thing. He just didn't know the difference. And he was in the hands of those who led him astray. Alger Hiss was still around and doing his worst, and the other pro-communists in the government were still there. And the results were not good. And of course, in 1950, in June, we got in the Korean War. And I remember that day very vividly. I was in Tocoa, Georgia. And the storm broke. I was with my brother. That had a brief revival of patriotism. And then in 1952, Eisenhower ran a tip on the thing. We've had enough, have you? Which was to bring the war to an end, get out. Eisenhower came in. Now, Eisenhower was allegedly Christian. And I certainly not judge his rebirth. I'm not going to do that. But he had almost no insight into a Christian policy for the government, even though he won by a landslide. He was not a statesman. He was not an incisive man. He was more the grandfatherly type. And while he wanted to do the right thing, he was hurt by a heart attack and by the liberals in the government. So that in the 1950s, the National Catholic Churches gained tremendous power in Congress, over the courts, and they established a lobby office in Washington. I want you to remember that, because when Mondale accuses Reagan of introducing religion to politics and accuses Jerry Falwell of doing it, he does not know what he's talking about. His own forebears from Minnesota, namely Hubert Humphrey, did the same thing. Hubert Humphrey had to bust in the National Council. He bust the National Council, and they politicked and lobbied in Washington as a registered lobbyist. So in the 1950s, the liberal theologians and the liberal religious leaders in the National Council, the Methodist Church, now United, the Northern Presbyterian Church, the United Church of Christ, and in intervening in political life. It was they who pushed for federal aid to education. It was they who pushed for many other things. They opposed any further military build-up against Russia, and pleaded with Eisenhower to meet with Khrushchev. As you may remember, he came over, put his shoe on the table. I'm giving a brief review, because with Kennedy in 1962, a change came in the American atmosphere. You could feel it in the air. Humanism mingled with unbelief and immorality rode hard in Washington. I was in Washington in 1960 at a meeting called by Billy Graham and Carl Henry to establish a Christian university in this country. We met in the hotel up on 14th Street, Connecticut Avenue. Oh, that's the name of the place. Anyway, I remember vividly because Carl Henry had just had an interview with Cardinal Cushing of Boston, in which Cardinal Cushing, in no uncertain terms, told Carl Henry that the America had just suffered a disaster. And he asked what he meant. He said he would elect Mr. Kennedy. And he said he's a disaster to the American people, and he'll be a disaster to the Catholic Church. He said that the American people, not understanding that he's not a good Catholic, will blame us for everything he does. Which was true. And what Mr. Kennedy did was not in accord with Cardinal Cushing. Cardinal Cushing was a very conservative Roman Catholic. And as you probably know, Mr. Kennedy had nude parties in the swimming pool in the White House. He had no morality of any kind. None of the Kennedys do. But John Kennedy led the race. Now, but that kind of an atmosphere came. I remember feeling this in 1960. I remember sitting at the breakfast table and telling my wife that the atmosphere of the country changed. It had. And some of you don't remember it. Most of you do, maybe. Remember what took place. Humanism was gaining ground. Radicalism was gaining ground. The whole Kennedy clan was a group of radicals and pro-communists. Now, we've come to 62. What are the more immediate backgrounds of the election? When Kennedy was assassinated, they brought Lyndon Johnson in. Now, Lyndon Johnson was more openly unscrupulous than Roosevelt. Roosevelt was devious. He worked behind the scenes, and he would slit your throat, but he'd smile at your wife, don't he, and say, doesn't this feel good?
Isn't that exactly what Johnson did in the politicking for the office?
No, he did it openly.
Well, he was the one who was saying he didn't want to get involved in Vietnam, though, in contrast to what Goldwater was saying.
Yeah.
And he turned right around after that.
Well, he was planning to get involved.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in his personal vendettas. Lyndon Johnson lied like nobody's business. Mm-hmm. So far as lying is concerned, in fact, I wouldn't say he outdid Roosevelt. I mean, there are very few people in American political life who could outdo Roosevelt in sheer lying. I remember, I was in Washington in 1939, and I remember him yet saying with great solemnity, "I will never send a mother's son to die in foreign soil." And the tears dripped from his eyes, and the tears dripped from his mouth. And every mother's son in this country breathed a sigh of relief, because Mr. Roosevelt would not do it. Of course, in 1939, in July, he'd already planned it. But he was running for 1940. And when Congress opened, he gave that, that stirring address. Just stir the emotions so deep. I'm being sarcastic.
Well, can you tell us anything about the guy who did not vote to go to war in Congress? There was one.
Yeah.
Why did he not vote?
That was a girl. That was a lady from Montana.
Oh, it was a lady.
Who had voted against it in 1917. I'm trying to remember. Helen I'm trying to remember her name. It's gone from me. But she did it again for the same reason. Now, what was her name? You've got me.
I'm sorry. No, I figured the reason that she might have voted was that she knew what was going on.
No. I remember Senator Will from Montana. He was campaigning for the president in 1940. And he said, he was talking about Roosevelt. And he said, Mr. Roosevelt buried every three American pigs out of four in the ground in 1933. Now in 1940, he's planning to bury three out of every American boy, four American boys on foreign soil. And of course, Mr. Roosevelt and Mr. Wheeler came to abrupt end so far as the alliance was concerned. They'd already come to it before. Wheeler opposed the Supreme Court bill, but not with the vehemence of the others. And Roosevelt wasn't happy with him, but when Mr. Wheeler made those remarks, that ended any sense of friendship. Because Mr. Wheeler called Mr. Roosevelt a liar, which was true. Now, with Lyndon Johnson, you have the open, unashamed policy of bribery and corruption in Florida. Mr. Johnson never won the election in Texas unless there were some deaths that involved him. I have a good friend. Turn this off. It went after Johnson withdrew, then Nixon defeated Humphrey in 1968, and McGovern in 1972. McGovern represents what Mondale represents today. Now,
McGovern once president of the National Council of Churches?
Not to my knowledge. I've done the whole
thing. I remember reading back during that election time that somebody was. That issue never came up, and the whole issue of Church of Churches State was around.
I ended my research, my writing, with 1972 in the National Council. I had to have a stopwalk date in order. And, but up to that time, he'd never been president of the National Council. If he was later, he could have been, but I don't remember. Cynthia Wendell was the leading spirit after that in that group. But with McGovern, the humanity philosophy got a firm hold in the Democratic Party. But you see, with his smashing defeat, humanism was put back on its hinges, so to speak. It suffered a serious blow. Any philosophy associated with McGovern took its blow too. Now, when Nixon came in, he did not divest himself of some of his influences. His was a mixed breed. Well, Colson at that time was an unbeliever. Some of the other people around him were just as bad, not worse. Probably worse. I never could figure Nixon out. He, in the 1968 campaign, he came to Salisbury and spoke in the Catawba Auditorium, not the chapel, but the big auditorium in the campaign. And then Billy Graham, about 1969, had him come and speak at Montreat. From morning service. I'll never forget that. The Secret Service were there. Everybody was there. He had been present then. And Montreat was jammed. We had rented a cottage, so we could walk down the auditorium, but the place was a mess. And Nixon tried to preach a sermon. it was a fiasco. It was humanistic, with some nice pious phrases thrown in, I could never figure out why Billy did that. We knew the Grahams pretty well in those days because our kids and their kids played together, and so we saw a lot of the Grahams, and I just couldn't figure it out. Billy tried to have an influence, I know, on Nixon. How much? I don't think Nixon's a humanist. But he didn't do much to stay the impulse.
Would you agree with Graham Sabin when he said that he believes that of all people in this century, Nixon is probably the most qualified for the office?
I think in sheer ability, sometimes badly misdirected, in sheer ability, I rate the following men at the top notch administrators. William Howard Taft.
Go slow on this, will you?
William Howard Taft was a very, very able man. Wilson was an able man, but he was not top notch. He was not a good administrator. Hoover was the administrator par excellence. Hoover lacked the ability to communicate what he was doing. Hoover, at the end of World War I, at the very end, had been appointed by Wilson Democrat, Hoover Republic, to be food administrator in Belgium. And Hoover has never received the credit that he deserved for the tremendous job he did in France and Belgium. Unbelievably fine job. With the precision of a little staff engineer.
Was that the food relief?
Yes.
Thing for all the starving peasants and stuff?
It was. And
he was a Democrat?
No, he was a Republican.
Republican. He talking about the didn't he go to Russia to
No. After the war.
No. After the revolution and
no.
With
it was after the revolution, because the revolution took place in 1917. And he didn't do very well, but that wasn't his fault.
He went though.
He went. But he did, and he was in Belgium and France, and he did a job that all the boys in the relief station should look at.
But in Russia, all the wrong people got all the food, didn't they?
Yeah, but that was not his fault. See, when you have a dictatorship, they steer the food to what they want. But you see, where there's no dictatorship, and where his policies could be carried out, he was tremendous. He'd come back and been in the Coolidge cabinet. He saved the Harding cabinet from complete disaster. Well, he was one of two or three that did. Secretary Mullen in the Treasury Department and Herbert Hoover in Commerce did a tremendous job. Now, when he's elected, he was a tremendously able administrator. But he simply could not communicate. He was a Quaker of the old school. He was a believing Quaker. He was a Christian man.
And you're talking about Hoover?
Pardon me? Herbert Hoover.
Hey, didn't he? I had read somewhere that all that old New Deal legislation had been introduced under Hoover and it was defeated. And then they took all that old New Deal legislation left over from Hoover and passed it in 100 days from Roosevelt.
Well, let me finish it there. The big contribution of Hoover was the Reconstruction Act of 1933, which put money into banks and into corporations. What the government did was to buy preferred stock in banks and corporations and thereby give them liquid capital for improvement. It was known as the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. That was successful. It was liquidated. And Roosevelt took the credit for it. Now, he did get that idea from Hoover. That is quite correct. Period. Hoover had other ideas which were very good, but which it is true. The Democrats in 1930 got control of Congress, and they voted down the Hoover program of Reconstruction because they were afraid it would work. This has been admitted. They were afraid it would work. And if it worked, you see, it would destroy the 1932 campaign. The best of the Hoover programs, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and the FDIC, were Hoover suggestions. Which they repudiated in 1930-31. Now, it has been generally agreed among the communists, they had been adopted. At that time, the FDIC and the RFC, that the whole picture of the Depression would have been changed because the FDIC set up the finance, I should say, it was the insurance program for banks, and the RFC, Reconstruction Finance Corporation, provided liquid capital for corporations to expand whatever they were doing, and that way it create employment. What's the matter? Do you have a question? See, what they want to do is get men back to work. Now, the best way to get men to work is to have industry employment. And the best way to stop bank failures is to have an insurance fund by which the banks could, on which they could draw man stop run. See, the minute you have a bank having a run on, and that bank's able to meet demands of runs. I remember vividly in Winston-Salem, cut this off, please. There was a bank which was held on a Hoover was an engineer. He was not a politician. He wanted a blueprint. He'd been trained to. He built the Hoover Dam. He was a great engineer. And when he had a plan, he said, "Oh, let's see the blueprint." Well, you see, that's all he learned at Leland Stanford. He hadn't learned to listen to politicians. And so he was charged to listen to politicians. It was one of his great virtues. I mean, you know, when you start to build a building, you like to have an architectural design. I mean, it's generally accepted. And if you're going to have an administration, you like to have a plan for it. And who couldn't understand you don't do that, you plan it by ear. Now, and the other point was that Hoover simply could not communicate. Now, I don't mean the criticism. He was not a popularizer. Actually, his popularity in the country in the early 1920s came from his work in Belgium. And Woodrow Wilson had the very good grace to play that up, if you want to use that word. In other words, Wilson was not selfish. He gave Hoover all the credit for all the tremendous things he'd done. He'd done an excellent job. Now,
so after Hoover, who would you say Nixon as far as the administration?
I would say Hoover, Taft, Hoover, and Nixon have been the great administrators, the 9-to-5 men. Time will tell about Reagan. Hoover, Nixon.
Are great administrators, or are you president?
Well, they're close. Hoover had a good foreign policy. He instituted the famous moratorium on debt, which France and England promptly repudiated, and that would have succeeded, among other things. It would have saved off the bank failures of Austria and France and England. That was a good idea. He had many good ideas, but you see, he was not a good popularizer. No. Generally speaking, there are some exceptions. The great popularizer is not your best president. No. Now, Reagan may turn out to be different, but your Lincoln was a very, very, very poor administrator. Mm-hmm. Probably one of our worst.
Worst.
What?
One of the worst.
The government ambled along. He had trouble with generals. He had trouble with Secretary of State. He had trouble with Secretary of Treasury. He was not a good administrator. Andrew Johnson was one of our best in the 19th century.
Oh, Truman.
Truman was a good old boy. Truman was in the hands of the enemies of the Republic. But to be fair to him, see, he'd have run a haberdashery store in Kansas City, Missouri, which is hard as a training for presidency. Secondly, he had been in the Senate. Turn this whole thing. Nixon was a stronger moral fiber, could have been one of our greatest presidents. But he had some very, very bad cronies. He used atrocious language. And he did not earn my respect. we've had far more able men in the 19th century than we have had in the 20th century. Washington, Adams, John Quincy Adams, Polk, Tyler. Tyler was a super duper. John Tyler, Virginia. John Tyler of Virginia.
What do you say about
super duper.
Oh.
An excellent minister, an excellent president. Andrew Johnson, probably the best constitutionalist after John Adams this country's ever had.
Mm. Would you rate Grant as probably the worst?
He's got too much coming. In 19th century presidents, he probably was the worst. Not in his own character, but in his total inability to run the administration. See, first and foremost, a president has to be a good administrator, or the whole thing falls apart. Grover Cleveland was a very able administrator.
The best president we've ever had had to be William Henry Harrison.
Well, his term was mercifully short.
Wasn't 1 month enough?
One month was enough. That's how Tyler got in. Mm-hmm. Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. That's a blessing for the country. I predict that in the less of the 20th century and in the 21st century, the presidency will sink to new lows with the politicians in.
Is it really possible?
Yes, it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you see the kind of reports that Mondo is getting. The kind of person he is. What do you think? What can we expect?
Now, the election of 1984. I've been giving the background. Obviously, today there are the philosophical issues which underlie the political issues. I guess it's 8:30. You probably ought to have a break, shouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
You ready for one?
Yes.
Some are. If I were to set the date, approximate date, for the background of the election of 1984, I would have to go to the year 1973. It was at that year, or in that year, that the Trilateral Commission was formed. Now, this was part of a program. As early as 1972, the time of the McGovern debacle, Abel Hyman and a group of like minds, unbelievers, radical humanists, decided that they would get a man to run for the presidency who would be above reproach and who, at least on the surface, would be able to appeal to many segments of the American public. For some reason, this part I've never been able to find out, Abel Hyman set his eyes on Jimmy Carter. It's partly because Carter had been governor of Georgia and had repeatedly achieved national success, which was not deserved, but nevertheless, he was noted as the progressive Christian governor of Georgia. And they decided that he would be a good front man. And and he would be the Democratic nominee in 1976. But in 1973, this same group, along with Nelson Rockefeller and a few others, formed a trilateral commission, which was composed of representatives from France, England, Belgium, the Netherlands, Sweden, Italy, Spain, Austria, along with candidate representatives from Japan and the United States, which would have as its aim the creation of one world government. It was an offspring of the Council on Foreign Relations, which had been formed at the end of World War II, World War I, to foster American cooperation with Soviet Russia and other nations. And it had really been formed at the time of the defeat of the League of Nations in Assam, the United States, to bring this nation a new era of internationalism for the avowed purpose of establishing what had not been established by the League of Nations because of the failure of the United States to enter it, namely a one world. Yes, Bill.
What do these group of men stand to gain from one?
This has often been asked. Abel Harriman was the son of the very famous president of the Union Pacific Railroad, one of the very rich men in the country. Of course, the Rockefellers, David and Nelson, were behind the Chase Manhattan Bank and many other international projects. As a matter of fact, they had financed Soviet Russia before World War I, and they were still financing Soviet Russia. And they had formed the American Soviet Trading Company to send heavy equipment to Russia. And I think I agree with Anthony Sutton, who points out that the real design was world power. It was to use their accumulated wealth to run the whole show. They not only intended to establish a one world government, but they thought that by their heavy investments in Soviet Russia and other countries, so-called undeveloped countries, they could control those countries. And they would supersede the American government, and they would create a one world government, which they too would control. That was the basic aim. It's a grasp for power.
Why do they think they could control these socialistic governments?
Well, well, I would answer that, Bill, by saying that they had financed these socialistic governments.
To the hilt.
What? To the hilt.
To the hilt. They put them in business.
They put them in business. And, and see, Great Britain Day is living off the Chase Manhattan Bank and other banks. Mexico, South Central America, South America, Iran, Iraq. No, I don't know about Iraq, but Iran, Poland, Spain, England are all living off American borrowed capital. France, the only nation in the West that isn't, is West Germany. And so it was based upon their thinking that when you control the purse strings, you control the company, the government. And so they're going to control the purse strings, and they were going to create a one world government which they then would control. That is the best I can see from all the documents I've seen.
Well, they really tried that on Mexico just last year.
No, they've done it.
Yeah. They really put Mexico on.
They put the squeeze on Mexico.
Because they wanted that control.
Uh-huh. Does that answer your question? Now, it might seem irrational to you. It might seem unpatriotic to you. I'm not arguing the moral of the case. I'm giving you the factual answers best I can. But they were willing to sell the country short to do it. Now, I say this because at first, this Trilogue Commission was not known publicly until 1976. I had known about through this former communist friend of mine, and I think I told you that when I went to see Jesse Helms. I forget what it was about. Anyway, I got talking to him and asked him something about the I traveled with a commissioner. I might as well have shot him. He jumped and looked at me and asked me how in the world I knew about it. That was a closely guarded secret. And I told him, and I didn't tell him the name. I said, through this former communist who's a close friend of mine now. And it was then that I wrote this man and asked him if I could reveal his name to Senator Helms, because Helms had been the executive secretary to Will Smith back in 51, 52, and 53 when I was his special advisor, and when we brought this man up before the commission because of his communist activities in Lenin. I say this because they were carefully laying their plans, and they were using Carter. And if you remember, Carter was inaugurated in 1977. But in 1976, we had the 200th anniversary of the founding of the Republic. And one of the leading members of the Trilateral Commission was a man named Henry Steele Commager. Now, he was part writer of the second volume in a very famous series of American histories called the Oxford History of the American Republic, the Morrison and Commager series. Morrison, this is a strange hookup. I never could understand it because Morrison was an evangelical, conservative, Orthodox Episcopalian. And Henry Steele Commager is one of the leaders of the American Humanist Movement. But he was at Harvard, and so far as the factual aspect is concerned, at that time he wrote good history. He wrote the second volume of The Growth of the American Republic, and Samuel Eliot Morrison wrote the first volume, which went down to the end of the war for independence, the war between the states. And Commager had become increasingly radical, and so in a parody on the Declaration of Jefferson, he wrote the famous Declaration of 1776, which began in this vein: when in the course of human events it become necessary for a country to surrender sovereignty and independence and to enter the world government, we therefore do this, this, and the other thing. Now, it was a deep secret, and it was to be read at that tremendous celebration which was to be held, and which was held at Philadelphia in July 1976. But I do not know this part of the story. I do know that the Philadelphia Inquirer, I think it's a morning paper with a large circulation, got hold of it and published it. And I'm sure they did it with malice aforethought, because that broke the bubble. And on July the 4th, they did not read it because it read such a popular, tremendous outroar. Now, from that time on, the Trilateral Commission was known pretty much to them, much the general public. It was this commission which forced Carter to arrange the transfer of the Panama Canal and to shall we say, to get along with Soviet Russia and her satellites. This was the general policy of the Carter administration. So you see, Carter had announced that he was a born-again Christian. Thus, you have a tremendous contradiction between, quote, the born-again Christian at the helm and the motley crew surrounding him. And it was a motley crew of out-and-out humanists. And I suppose there were some evangelicals among them, but Bill Moyers wasn't one of them. And certainly his Secretary of State left a lot to be desired. And so did some of the others. And you may remember that out of this grew a tremendous rustle among the evangelicals. All in the meantime, the Supreme Court in 1973 had issued the famous, or the infamous decision of Roe versus Wade, which was the abortion case. But it had also, you may not know this, but it had given forth the great decision involving capital punishment. And it was a George case. It had ruled against capital punishment, and it had ruled in favor of abortion, and it was on a very radical course. The abortion case did more than anything else, I think, I suppose you can say that the Roe decision, in the long run, has had more impact upon the evangelical emergence than did the Trilateral Commission. But the Trilateral Commission was behind a lot of these events, which brought the evangelical movement to the forefront. And in the 1970s, 1980s, you see you had this tremendous conflict and contrast between what Carter says he is and what Carter does. And the the people who surrounded Carter, who were far from evangelical. Now, I'm not suggesting that Mr. Carter was not reborn. I am no physician to judge his soul. I don't intend to. But so far as his presidential actions were concerned, he certainly favored the humanist side. He certainly favored the communist side. And he certainly allowed the American military to become very seriously weakened, both the Navy and the Army, and particularly the Air Force. Now, he was surrounded by men who wanted to weaken us in regard to Soviet Russia, so that we would be forced to come to terms with Russia. Now, in the late 1970s, Jerry Falwell formed a rather loose organization. I don't mean that in a derogative sense. I mean simply a loose coalition of various groups, the Moral Majority. Whether it played a major role in the 1980 election or not, it's hard to tell, because the conservative forces in general had been so alarmed and so awakened and made so very fearful by the Carter administration that a reaction was bound to take place. And you see what it did. It awakened the alarm of those evangelicals who for years had been sitting on the benches and saying, we'll have no part to play. You see, except for the Roman Catholics in it and the Jewish element that that supports it, the backbone of the Moral Majority is among the independent fundamentalist Baptists and independent churches. There's no doubt about that. The leader in North Carolina has an independent church just outside of Raleigh. Now, he's a good man. I'm not for a moment, downgrading, not at all. But they're independent. Now, it was this group, under the impact of the Schofield Reference Bible and the Bible School movement and related movements, which said, no, the world, the Christ is going to come very soon, and we will not involve ourselves in political affairs at all because he will come. My wife's mother, for years, believed that Hitler was the Antichrist. And she really believed the world was going to come to an end before 1939. When Hitler died that ignominious death, first it was Mussolini, then it was Hitler, and then it was the Russian, Stalin. Now, she had picked out the three leaders of who would be the Antichrist, and that Christ must come. Well, he didn't. You see, in the meantime, they had been allowing these situations to develop. They didn't like the National Council. I don't either. But you see, they said, well, look, we'll leave that field alone. Well, the National Council continually works. The National Council worked in league with the Trilateral Commission. It worked in league with the court on the Roe decision and the Gregg decision regarding capital punishment and other decisions. It was influencing the court, it was influencing Congress, it was influencing Carter, and the time had come to put a halt to it. Now, in 1980, we know the story.
Wasn't there somewhat also in reaction to the phrase that Nixon had coined in the silent majority, that Falwell was somewhat attempting at least to get the church out of its silence?
Yeah.
And saying something in the political realm?
Nixon had used that phrase in the 1972 campaign, the silent majority, which did speak, I must admit, with great force, but it was not so much on religious issues as it was to continue what at that time seemed to be a very sound Nixon administration. We must remember, in all fairness to Richard Nixon, that in his first administration, he did achieve a tremendous amount of success. I would never deny the man had ability. Whatever we may think about him personally, as long as things were going well, He did. Now, the thing that I've never been able to understand is why they ever raided the Watergate offices. Because it was obvious. It was obvious. I mean, if Humphrey had been defeated, which he was, that he was really a strong runner compared to McGovern. I mean, McGovern was pitiful. Absolutely pitiful. And for them to pick to McGovern to pull out Trigger was the height of stupidity. Now, the excuse, the reason was, and I think it was valid, that McGovern was in cahoots with communist sources. And according to this former communist friend of mine, they did find communist material in the Watergate offices. But that was never brought out. That was spoiled the whole game. There's no doubt in my mind that it was a frame-up. That somehow the Democratic High Command knew about it. That it was something that was leaked to them. I'm not saying by whom, I don't know. But why they would suddenly decide to look at offices, I mean, by the time this happened, who would care about your office? I mean, it was so obvious that the election was over, that to suddenly get concerned about your office and go down there at night to find out it's there in itself should have been examined. There was something decidedly off color there. And to come there at the right time, well, it all adds up in my mind that it was a frame up.
Have the paper there too that was against Jeff?
What?
Have convenient access to the paper?
It was arranged, and Nixon and the boys fell for it. But until that happened, Nixon was an effective president. Perhaps I should have included him in the list. I guess it's my disdain for his language and his uncouthness, but he certainly had a great deal more ability than Eisenhower. See, but you must remember that in 1952, Nixon had the famous fur coat incident. I don't remember, you all remember that enough, but his wife was accused of having received a fur coat. And on TV one night, he brought her out and prayed her with his fur coat and said, "Would I give Thurman the presidency for that and that?" You know, and by the time he had her crying, he had the TV audience boohooing, and all America was weeping floods. And that was 32 years ago. And you see, he turned what could have been a political tragedy into a triumph by some slick oratory. But he couldn't do that in 1973 and 4 when the final blow came. So when you add these things up, you have another factor. The high rate of inflation, the economic stagnation, the whole situation economically in 1978-79-80 was against Carter. When Reagan came in, he used the old-fashioned, what we call supply-side economics. And every economist, with one or two exceptions, had solemnly declared it wouldn't work. They were, most economists, they are very liberal, not all of them. But see, the academia is very liberal, from liberal to communist. Therefore, when Reagan comes out and says, "We're going to try the supply-side approach," they were convinced it wouldn't work. Because that's what they believe, that's what they've been taught by their own professors. And now here comes this hyena from California, this movie actor, this slick trick boy, and he's going to try it.